There's a drive way back. It might be. It could be. It is. Holy cow. Welcome to another broadcast of Bricks Behind the Ivy. Here's your host, Jeff and Sean.
Hey, Cup fans. Welcome back to another episode of Bricks Inside the Ivy. I am always am Jeff Rogowskis, Canon Cubs. Here with me, as always, is Sean Chapin as Hot Stove Cubbies. And how you doing today, Sean?
Oh, I'm doing great. Watching Cubs baseball on TV has been delightful.
Yeah, I think it's been such a welcome change. It was 70 degrees in Chicago recently, and being able to pop the game on, just the audio, while I was outside playing t-ball with my kids, you know, I think that just really gets me excited for baseball season more than some spring training games do at times. But it's been a warm welcome, quite literally, to have this season shift and see some Cub games. And recent announcements, too, have Marquee doing some simulcasting on local television. Yeah. So expanding the market, as you know, the RSN networks are, you know, struggling for customers and such. It's nice to see Marquee kind of pivoting to make sure that people are seeing Cub games, which at the end of the day should be the most important thing.
Yes.
No. So today, since we are talking about spring training, we have, you know, a decent number of games under our belt. We're recording this episode on Wednesday, March 6th, for point of reference for whoever's listening. And I think there's been a few players that we've discussed that we're watching specifically, maybe performance-based, maybe looking for something specifically for them to do in spring training. And I think, you know, we're both smart baseball guys, self-declared smart baseball guys, and we are aware of small sample size alert, which I feel like might be the title of this podcast, but there are still some guys that we're looking at, and we've seen things we like, or we're seeing progression and specific things that we want to see, and I think it's, you know, time to kind of talk about some of those. Sean, who are you looking at so far as, you know, top performers, or what are you watching this spring?
So I went into the spring, you know, looking at Christopher Morel and defense, and not a great game for him today, but
no,
defensively, but one player that I kind of went into as, you know, almost an afterthought, and now I this term gets overused now, but the alien term, you know, like he's out of this world, he's an alien. I'm really feeling like Matt Shaw is going to be that guy for the Cubs. His stats don't jump off the page, you know, again, small sample size. He's had at this time 19 at bats, batting .263 with a .792 OPS. However, the thing that just jumps out at me is the ball coming off his bat. The sound that it makes, it's just, he is such a good hitter at such a young age. And it is just crazy how fast this guy is moving up through the system. And, you know, when I look at his at-bats, when I look at him in the batter's box, you get this feeling, you know, and I'm sure you can relate, Jeff, but there's a few Cubs hitters that I can remember that just look like they're going to get a hit every time they go up to bat. I call it hitterish. You know, he just looks hitterish. He looks like that guy. One of the Cubs, former Cubs that I'm not saying Matt Shaw is going to be this guy, but one of the guys that when he got up in the box, you're like, he's going to hit a homer. He's just going to hit the crap out of the ball. And that's Aramis Ramirez. I mean, that's a guy that I'm looking at as a guy who just looks like he was always going to hit. Matt Shaw is in that category. And we've seen it this spring. He has such a sweet swing. He has that gap power that is something that's so impressive. And at his young age of 22, his pitch recognition on whether to go the other way or to pull the ball is just fascinating to me. He went from a guy that I'm like, oh, cool, that, you know, that's awesome. You know, we heard about him moving up through the system quickly last year and stuff, but I did not have him on my radar whatsoever for the spring. And now I'm like, this guy is going to make his major league debut this year. No doubt about it.
I saw John Morrissey tweet that actually today after, or maybe it was yesterday, Shaw had made a play at third base and he tweeted, this guy's going to be in the major leagues in 2024. And I almost replied snarkily of, duh. I think it's, you know, when I saw this guy get drafted, I was, you know, one of the things I have gotten to do the last few years has turned into a tradition is I've gone to the All-Star game. And last year they had third year of the live amateur draft. But I believe it was the second year in which you could just attend as a fan, where the first year they weren't really letting people in without like specific tickets and stuff when I was in Colorado. But yeah, last year it was at where the Seattle Seahawks play. I can't think of the name of the stadium right now, but it was outside Lumen Field. And I was looking at prospects and live tweeting the guys coming off the board and had read a bunch about how advanced this guy's bat was. And my first thought when I hear advanced bat draft is Kyle Schwarber. That was the play when they got Schwarber. It was the play when they got Chris Bryant. It's, you know, those college bats have, you know, weathered different levels of talent, and depending on the conference they play in, you know, they're playing versus future major leaguers, and those sample sizes mean a little bit more than, excuse me, maybe a high school player, and you know, they're a little less risky when you make those selections. And yeah, I think the bat was something that seemed like a very valid gamble of, you know, this guy's going to hit in the major leagues. It's been the position, and you know, so far he's looked pretty solid in different places on the field. And, you know, I think that's less in question. And, you know, I think once there is clear availability or need on this roster, he's going to be up quite quickly. And I would not be shocked if he starts the season at AAA instead of another cup of coffee at AA. I don't think there's anything left to prove there. So, yeah, I get why you're excited about him.
Yeah, one of the things that I wanted to touch on this, and you made a great point, is that, you know, when he was being scouted, one of the things that just drew rave reviews is he had a 26% launch angle, and he was in the 90th percentile, the 90th percentile in exit velocity in college. That, I mean, that right there, you know, those advanced metrics is what geeks like us fall in love with. And obviously the Cubs front office felt the same way. And he's putting it on display in spring, which is really impressive. One of the things I was kind of looking at, I'm like, man, who does he remind me of? And I started looking at player comps, and two of the player comps that jumped out right away was some player comp Ian Kinsler, and another one is Bo Bichette. Now I'm telling you right now, if he's either one of those players, the Cubs got something great. Absolutely. I mean, like, if he can have a career of Ian Kinsler playing second base or even third base, you know, or a Bo Bichette, oh my gosh, I mean, that is great. But the one player that jumped out, and I haven't seen this anywhere else, but I've watched some video and stuff, and I'm like, I'm hesitant to even say his name because people are going to be like, wow, he is extremely optimistic Cubs fan. You know, the Twitter
handle. Hot take alert incoming.
David Wright. I think he fits the profile of David Wright. I just don't want him to hit the injury list like David Wright did and end his career way too early. But David Wright.
I want everyone to know who is listening to this in audio that my fists are going up and down, hitting the wood table where all my stuff is on, knocking on wood, trying to like just scare away the baseball demons from that comp and the injury history associated. It's like comparing a pitcher to Mark Pryor. It just is going to give me PTSD. It's just not something that's in my top five that I want to hear.
Yeah. But he just seems like that type of hitter. And they profile, you know, body size. David Wright's a little bit heavier, but they're both sit right around that 5'11", 6 foot. And just the swing from both is so sweet. Bat speed's great. Willing to go the other way, but willing to let it rip when they get their pitch and pull it. So Matt Shaw has just put on an absolute display this spring, even though those stats just don't jump off the page. But if you watch him, if you've watched games, this guy, you're starting to say, well, he could. Is he better than Morel at third base? Do we go with him? You know, there's a lot of people on Twitter that are like, let's just roll with him at third and then put Morel at DH, you know? And if the Cubs decided to do that, I would be fine with it. But I think he starts in AAA, as you stated. But yeah, that's one of my guys to watch. Jeff, who's your first guy to watch?
Well, this one's near and dear to my heart always. And I would say that who I'm watching is just a bias because they have been my favorite Cub for a number of years. My son is named after him, Kyle Hendricks. I just have thought the world of how he's been able to manage the shoulder injury he's had and come back and be an effective major league pitcher last year in a lot of different ways. He just was one of the top rated breaking ball values on Baseball Savant. And this is a guy that I think going into 2023, a lot of folks wrote him off as potentially having an injury in which he would never pitch again. And the Cubs came up with strength programs and changed some things in his routine. And he's just, I love every time Pitching Ninja shares a gif of Kyle Hendricks like finishing a hitter off with a changeup or something, and he's like, look at that arrogant strut in mid-season form, and he's like walking off the mound like it's game 7 of the World Series. It's
so great.
And it's I remember all too like the jokes in 2016 about like Kyle Hendricks went home after Game 7 the World Series and enjoyed a celebratory glass of milk. And it's just like, he does give this impression of just like being this like really like content, happy guy. And he has the work ethic and just the another one of my new favorite baseball terms. Sean Marshall dropped this on the broadcast today on Marquee: pitchability. I love that term. It's that's not a word. It is now in baseball. It's a word. Pitchability. And it reminds me of the NBA basketball with spurtability, which like, was. But yeah, I think one thing that I was looking for from Kyle Hendricks in spring training is the curveball. There is a lot of documentation, and he, I believe, admitted it in an interview in preseason that he was not using the curveball last year, which in years past was a super effective, like, get me over, change of pace pitch for him. And he said that he just didn't feel like he had a good grip, and he feels way better about the grip he has now. So I've been, you know, looking for more curveball usage. I haven't seen a ton, but I think as the spring goes on, that's something I'm looking for. His numbers this spring aren't like jumping off a page, but it's just, you know, a few starts. I believe he's had 2 starts at this point. And, you know, there's been the classic, not really like many Kyle Hendricks walks. He had specifically referencing that Pitching Ninja tweet, he had a changeup that moved the way that I would expect a Kyle Hendricks changeup to move against a left-handed hitter, in which it was, you know, doing the fade. And there was one doing against right-handed hitter that had more of that kind of cut away action. And I remember back when he was, you know, kind of in prime's not the word, but when he was just absolutely dominating baseball, had an absurdly low ERA. I believe that was in 2016. He talked a lot about his changeup having, you know, 2 grips, and one was kind of like a cut change, and the other one was just a straight change. And he deployed them, you know, depending on the side of the batter. And I saw a little bit more of that movement, where last year I felt it was hard to discern, and I would like to look at more advanced data and should have before this conversation. It was hard to discern the path of the sinker and the path of the changeup against left-handed hitters, because they were both, you know, moving arm side. And you, Kyle Hendricks' key to success is tunneling and perception of velocity. And if your sinker is only like plus two, plus three MPH to his changeup, and they're both on the same path, like you can kind of sit on the direction of the baseball. And when you're not having that, you know, that curveball to mix in, you know, that changes what he can do, even on like a contact management basis, so dynamically. And I mean, here's the stat that jumps out to me. So in 2020, he used his curveball 16% of the time, nearly 17% of the time. And even as recently as 2021 and 2022, he was still at 12%. Last year was 3.5%. And the pitch that made up for that difference, just a huge jump in changeup usage, 41.4. So it would be interesting, since the sinker had been dropping significantly in recent years, if that was associated to his arm trouble, or if some of his changeups based on velocity or his sinkers were registering on changeups, like just on the movement profile I felt like I was seeing. So that's what I'm watching for. Kyle Hendricks kind of getting into a good feel on his changeup. You know that he's a lock for this rotation. His numbers this spring aren't going to matter. You know that they're going out there with this objective of like, similar to what Tommy Hadavi had said to Jordan Wicks in that preview of like, just throw your changeup. Don't worry about throwing for strikes. Just get a feel for the pitch. And that's what a lot of these guys are doing. And it just has been encouraging to see this early movement that I'd want to see on his pitches. Is there anyone else catching your eye, Sean? Who else are you looking at?
Yeah, Jose Quas. I hope I said that right. He came over in the Nelson Velasquez trade. Did really pretty well last year. 3.04 ERA with a good K rate. Walk rate still was pretty high, 5.3 per nine. But so far this spring, he's been looking pretty good. Again, small sample size, four innings pitch, six Ks with one walk and surrendering two hits. The one thing that I love about Jose is the funky arm angle. I mean, the delivery, the funky arm angle, and he just, I love the movement that he gets on pitches. It kind of reminds me of, in a way, Carlos Marmol. I don't think he knows where the pitches are going sometimes, but neither does the batter. And he's made that movement and run has made hitters look a little silly this spring. I mean, there were some really bad swings on that. It, to me, he's just going to be one of those guys in Craig Counsell's pen that he's going to utilize correctly. He's going to be, you know, Counsell is a mastermind of the bullpen, and the amount of arms that are going to be, you know, consistent on the roster, but also moved up and down through AAA, because that happens every single year. He is just going to be a great weapon out of there, especially when you go against a guy with a lot of power. I mean, that kind of movement is really tough to square up.
Yeah, and I think there's not a lot on Quas's, you know, Savant or Baseball Reference page. It's going to stick out, but, you know, I give this front office some leeway on finding guys that they can bring into their pitch system and address some arm angle, some grip changes, you know, that there was kind of this, the sweeper movement that came from the pitch lab, the legendary Cubs pitch lab, and, you know, whatever's in that IV computer system we've heard so much about. I think this guy having an off season with the Cubs development department and still being as good as he was at times for the Cubs, I'm pretty excited to see what he can do. And I think when he's locked in and he's locating, this fastball is pretty strong and it's got some good tail on it. And he had two strikeouts in the game the other day, in which, you know, batters were backing off on a pitch that moved to the outside corner. So that means, you know, the arm angle and the perception of the ball is definitely fooling some hitters. But if he's, I've seen some sliders from him that have been really encouraging this spring training as well. I'm sure that's something you've probably noticed as well, that, you know, if he can make that pitch a weapon and, you know, kind of diminish the usage of, you know, the sinker, the fastball, man, like I trust that Cubs, you know, development machine in the bullpen. They've turned some, oh God, I really don't want to use the phrase that I'm thinking of, but they've turned some real trash into treasure, and that's way better than the original metaphor. I was gonna say turds, but they've turned some trash into treasure. I think they did a better job this offseason of addressing that too, because I just felt like that was definitely the Achilles heel down the stretch. And like, we can talk about overusage or exposure, unable to cover as many innings in the rotation, guys throwing more than they ever have, all those factors come into play. But yeah, they really need to address some things in the bullpen. I think there's a better mix, and I think this guy can very quickly become something that Craig Counsell will deploy very well.
Yeah. So moving on to your second guy you're watching this spring, who do you got?
Yeah, this one I guess is a little more depressing. Only currently, we'll see how the concussion protocol progresses. But Brennan Davis, you know, I think Cub prospects. I'm going to go on a little bit of a sidebar tangent here. Cub prospects in my life have had just such a wide range of expectations. And just a volume of farm system rankings. And, you know, I should spend some time look at the farm system rankings from when I was a kid. But there was always that guy that was like the second coming in Cub world that came up here and was maybe an average baseball player at best. Or Felix was the season. Yeah, that was the first one that came to my mind. another one, Corey Patterson. You know, I'll always thank Bobby Hill for being part of that Aramis Ramirez trade package, but like that was another one we heard for years. And, you know, like obviously Starlin had Heesop Choi. That's another good one. Like there's just a litany of these Cub players that just, and you wonder, like, did they inherit the seat on their shoulders and a team that always managed roster decisions on what if, not like what could, like what they should be doing. And before the Theo days. So when I think of Brennan Davis, I think of like a top prospect in a system that wasn't as strong. And I think of that 2001 Futures game specifically, which I'm still mad that I chose to eat lunch and watch the game, Futures game in Colorado instead of going to the game. I was in Colorado for that All-Star game, and he had two home runs in that game. And he, you know, ended up winning the MVP. He looked great. He had a great season that year. He had, you know, kind of skyrocketed through the system. The strikeouts were dropping. The OBP was going up. That ISO was looking great. Like, all the things on an advanced metric standpoint, showing that, like, you know, he was making the moves. But, man, this guy has just had buzzard luck on injury. He's had back issues, concussions, weird ankle issues that have just kept him off the field for like 2 years. He's not on a radar for anyone. So when he came in the spring and, you know, had 2-3 extra base hits and 7 at bats, a crunched home run, like that swing was looking level, health issues behind him. He gets this concussion. It's like, come on, like give this kid a break. He looks so good.
Right.
And like early in the spring, I started having conversations with myself about, like, I'm like, man, it's like, so Brennan Davis might be a thing again, and we have Canario and Alcantara that still could become the Jaguar. Greatest nickname in baseball, by the way.
Awesome
if we're going to talk about it.
not the greatest, because the pitching philosopher that Imanaga has is probably my favorite.
That's pretty good. Yeah, like we have we now have a professor and a philosopher. Wrigley Baseball, where you can be a scholar in a short summer. but yeah, I think, like, you know, it just adds to a crowded outfield picture for the Cubs, which, you know, increases their ability to trade for needs at this deadline, next offseason. As we all know, there's kind of just some lock starters in there now, depending on the Cody Bellinger opt-out situation again after this season. Yeah. But yeah, it's just a really interesting player. I would really like him to just stay healthy. I think depending on how long this concussion thing goes out, it's very likely he goes to AAA. I'm interested, depending on how he does in AAA, unless there's some major injury, knock on wood. If he gets back up to the major league club, this bench is becoming a really interesting conversation. And given 40-man, people who are on the 40-man, people who aren't on the 40-man, the type of positional flexibility they're going to look for early in the season, defensive management, especially at third base, like who's a contact guy, who's a good pinch hitter. Like there, I think there's still a trade out there to address that. Caleb Killian, Bleacher Nation, Brett Taylor, always on top of pretty much everything. Just huge fan of his. He had brought the point up that if Killian's arm issue from yesterday, which also sucks, that's another guy I was watching.
Super bad.
If he ends up like being injured, he could open up a 40-man roster spot by going on the DL, and that is not what you want to see to solve a roster issue, but it does, you know, open an additional opportunity for, you know, kind of managing this bench, which I am kind of at a loss at, you know, what the good decisions are for, you know, the outside the everyday players, like what the complement pieces need to be.
Yeah. But, I mean, I said something on X, I think it was either yesterday or the day before. There's really right now 9 players battling for 4 positions on the bench. And that is crazy to think about. Like, legitimately 9 players that have a shot to make it. And some of them are in our eyes. I mean, like Dominic Smith and Garrett Cooper, I mean, they both could be good players. I think Dominic Smith has a bigger hill to climb with being left-handed, but like you have all these position battles. I mean, when you look at Madrigal, is Madrigal really needed if you're going with a Miles Mastroboni? Is Wisdom the guy that you're going to go with who has good power, or are you going to go with more along the lines of a Garrett Cooper who's not going to strike out as much, provide better defense at first base? But again, Wisdom gives you more flexibility. I think it's the bench is an interesting thought in how they're going to go about this. And like you said, they opened up a 40-man spot, and there's a guy out there that smashes right-handed and left-handed bats. And I know he's just a strictly a DH, but JD Martinez is out there too. I don't think they're going to go that route, but it's just, there's other options out there. And as we start seeing the cuts made and stuff, I think you're going to see a lot more movement this spring. You're going to see some guys moved that are on the 40-man for the Cubs. I think you're going to possibly see maybe not a major trade, but a trade that'll kind of have you turning your head, because there's a lot of talent in spring training for the Cubs this year. You know, it's not like previous years where you're kind of like, gosh, we got to just throw this person on the roster. You know, I really feel like this year, it is something to watch. It is something to keep an eye on, and it's going to get really creative. And I know Craig Counsell is going to do his best with whatever he's given, but I want to give him the best. And I really think the front office is looking at that and looking both outside and inside to see what that roster looks like by opening day.
Yeah, I think surprise is not the correct word, but when they confirmed this past week and that Mike Tauchman's going to be on the opening day roster, you know, I think it just kind of just narrowed the opportunities for the remaining players more than I was surprised that was happening. Yeah, it's just, and you had tweeted out the other day, you know, like the locks on this roster. So we're looking at, you know, probably 13 pitchers for the Cubs, an outfield of Happ, Belly, Suzuki, Tauchman, and then an infield, like, given what we've been told about reps, like Michael Busch, Nico Swanson, Morel, obviously, and Gomes and Amaya, they're going to carry 2 catchers. So that leaves three spots for the group of Canario, Wisdom, Master Bony, Madrigal, Mervis, Dom, Cooper, Vasquez, Bodhi, Peralta, and PCA. And, you know, like PCA, I think it's just, it's probably a conclusion at this point that he's going to Triple A.
And for sure.
It really is about playing every day. Like, he needs to work on the things that he needs to work on. And it's not that he's been bad this spring. It's just, you know, reps. He's in the stage of his development where reps are really important and will probably be one of the first up if needed. And, yeah, the rest of these guys, yeah, I don't think we need to carry another first baseman. They're not going to cut ties with Wisdom. You know, David Bodie is not even on the 40 man, which I had forgotten about. And that changes, you know, some things. Like Dominic Smith, not in the 40 man. David Peralta, I can't remember. Has he played yet? I'll be honest.
I think had like two at bats. I think that's what I've seen.
And Garrett Cooper, I've seen a few of his at-bats, and honestly, that was a signing that did intrigue me, because I remember him being a high contact, like, solid on-base hitter. So, like, getting a guy like that off the bench, I'm kind of pro that, but yeah, there needs to be a 40-man roster move, and yeah, I do like, if I had to pick, I like Mastroboni over Madrigal, because Mastroboni can play second. He can play
short.
He can play short, yes, like in outfield. An emergency. You know, and like exactly, he was our starting right fielder last year. I don't know how many people are going to recall that. And man, boy, did he get! He had like just such a terrible sample size of hitting the ball really hard right at dudes in April last year, and just the fan base.
I turned on him so hard. I'm sorry, Miles, if you're watching this podcast.
I recall too, like there was a play. It was in an early game where he just like he read the ball bad and gave up a few late runs to cough up the lead, and it might have been versus the Brewers. And it was just that I remember the first thought I was like, oh god, Suzuki gets that ball. There's some irony in that statement considering what happened in Atlanta later in the year. But like, I mean, ultimately, I think. You know, I like his flexibility on this roster more than some of the other options. And damn it, I want to see Canario on the team. I'm so interested in what that is in a larger sample size. Like the talking about sounds off a bat, like that guy is fun to watch. And he's got some Harold Ramirez vibes to me. And what I mean by that is, like, not giving him the chance and him, like, going to Tampa and just making you sad. Like, the Cubs, like, just didn't really have a good first base option, and this guy goes over there and makes a freaking all-star team, like, as a first baseman and hits 285 with all these bombs and, oh my gosh, just, like, and we're sitting with the Eric Hosmer pre-retirement experience where he's hitting the ball at an exit velocity that's lower than most into the ground at a higher rate than any human in the history of time. That's probably a little mean. I'm sorry.
Taking balls on first base on the in foul territory. I mean, come on, man.
The guy won a gold glove, and I've never seen someone look so uncomfortable around a bag. Like, I mean, and I've watched myself play first base, which is an experience, let's be honest. Like, for anyone who's listening who's seen that, I'm sorry. But the guy, even I know not to cross that bag. You're going to get hurt there. But, yeah, I think there's not to get, you know, too far off track, but I feel like we've officially addressed the bench issue. Like, it's definitely something, you know, in with it first, based on recording time, the first cuts are the deepest, one of my favorite annual references. But yeah, I think, you know, as the spring goes on, we'll continue to watch and see how this roster shapes out and have a better idea of, you know, what we're looking at for opening day. And as one more special treat this week, we were able to lock down Brett Taylor from Bleacher Nation for a quick interview on our pod.
We love Bert.
Yes, exactly. You know, I've definitely, you know, from afar have idolized his work and really like his commentary that, you know, really tap dances that line of extremely solid analysis while kind of putting that spin of like that hopeful fandom heart. And I think that's extremely difficult to do. And he just does it so well, which is probably why he is one of the, you know, more followed Twitter accounts and one of the more, you know, reliable sources of Cubs news. And yeah, I have, how often do you visit Bleacher Nation, Sean?
Oh my gosh. Are we talking a day? Probably 3 or 4 times. I always go. I mean, his writing's fantastic, and just the whole entire Bleacher Nation family. I know there's a lot of people that go into that. He just does a great job. His lives are great, and also what he does from a charitable standpoint for when he stays up. I think it's for 8 days now, Brett. I think 8 days. Is what it seems like he stays up for 8 days right around the trade deadline, which is a really cool thing that he does. So, he is one of my favorite followers on Twitter. He interacts with everybody and he's hilarious and he's such a good guy. So, yeah, it's a real treat for us.
Yeah, absolutely. And I did promise I would use absolutely less, but you know, apparently I'm not a man of my word. But without further ado. Here is our conversation with Brett Taylor from Bleacher Nation. All right, Cub fans, thanks again for sticking around. As we said, we have a very special guest today. Brett Taylor from Bleacher Nation is joining us. If you have not found him on the internet, then you are missing out. This is the best place to go to find all the news on the Cubs, all transactions, and some pretty in-depth analysis on salary cap and all the different things, the CBT, that you would be interested in a general year. And there is just so much, I would say, balance between just real analytical thought and the fan heart that goes into all of the different minutiae and transactions with the Chicago Cubs. Brett, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, well, thank you, Jeff, for those very kind words in the introduction. So, yeah, happy to chat with you.
No, I've been a huge fan of yours and your site for a really long time. I honestly can't remember when I started reading Bleacher Nation, but I know that myself and Sean, my partner, co-host in this podcast, he and I are on your website several times a day as every new story gets updated to just try to stay like as on the pulse as a fan, which obviously is short for fanatic, needs to be when you are as obsessed with this North Side bunch of players as we are. But yeah, I wanted to kind of talk to you a little bit about your Cubs origin story. How did you end up becoming a Cubs fan?
Yeah, really about, there's two main drivers of it. One being, so my dad's family was from the Chicago area. So I've lived in Ohio my whole life, but my dad's family was from the Chicago area. He was a big baseball guy. And he sort of planted those seeds early on when I was a little kid, just sort of generally the baseball seeds, but you sort of felt a little bit of a connection to Chicago. My brother grew up a White Sox fan. I grew up a Cubs fan. And so that was a component of it. But then what really cemented it, as it did for a lot of people of our generation, is that I could watch the Cubs every afternoon on WGN. You know, you come home from school and you just want to watch some baseball, and that's the team that's on. And so you get accustomed to it, and you do that for a few years, especially as a kid. And before you know it, you realize, oh, I'm just kind of hooked and love this team. And, you know, I was very fortunate that started getting into them around that 89 season. They were very good. And then of course, early 90s, you had Mark Grace and Ryan Sandberg and Sean Dunstan, and then Sammy emerged. And, you know, for as much as they weren't winning, which they rarely did in that era, it was very fun. There were a lot of things to enjoy about that team. And so it just really stuck to me, and never could shake it.
Yeah, I relate to that pretty strongly. And I think one thing that I have learned about myself as a Cubs fan and just a general baseball fan is there was a lot of, I would say, like steep learning curve and educational moments when you would get to August and have the realization that the Cubs were not a competitive baseball team and the sport you loved was going to be on for several more months. So I feel like that kind of opened the door for myself to, you know, watch other teams, get a broader idea of the general landscape of what competitive baseball looks like. Is that something you found yourself doing as well?
Probably when I was younger. It's funny, I have, because I've been doing the job that I do now for so long, I almost have trouble remembering what fandom was like before I mean, I'm still very much a fan, but it's sort of like I'm a professional fan. I have to observe everything through that lens.
Sure.
And now for me, like the years when the Cubs are non-competitive, it's almost like they, you know, of course we follow all the rumors and all that stuff, but August and September become these tryout period, these exploration periods for what the following season might be, for some of the off-season decisions. And while I would never say I prefer that to competitive months down the stretch, I have generally found I still enjoy those. I also enjoy, so when the Cubs are out of it in August and September, there aren't stakes to the games. And so, of course, I like watching the Cubs when there are stakes, but when they're not, at least you can exhale. And it's like, look, they win or lose today, who cares? I'm observing players, I'm observing development and these kinds of things. And so you can at least exhale in August and September, very different from last year, for example, where not yes. only was every game in August, September mattered, every game was like a one run game. Every single game was tight to the end. That was exciting, but it was also very exhausting last year.
No, I totally, I understand that. I feel this, felt the same exhaustion. And it's interesting, you know, just thinking about how last year ended and then the pace of this off season and how much I feel like, you know, for myself and seeing the echo chamber that is, you know, X and some of the Cub fan forums and stuff that exists, there seems to be a general exhaustion maybe going into this season and what the team should be doing and what we thought they were going to be doing and, you know, plan A, plan B, plan C off season. What did you think in general about this Cubs off season, its pace and what they accomplished?
I mean, I think now we're here March 7th, off season is probably over Cubs maneuverings and we can look at it as an entire finished product of an off season. And I think it was good. I think they checked the boxes that needed checking and they added Craig Counsell. And I think it's odd to me. A lot of people aren't including that as part of the off season. And I think much of that is due to the fact that it happened right at the start of the off season and then nothing happened for a long time. So I think there was a frustration paired to the idea of the Cubs getting Craig Counsell and then not making moves to the big league roster for several months thereafter. And so I think people have just kind of got it at a gut feel level that they don't like to include Counsell as part of the offseason because it reminds them of that period of time when they were frustrated that that was the only thing the Cubs did. But you step back and you think, okay, well, the Cubs, at a minimum, needed to replace Marcus Stroman's production in the rotation. They got Shota Imanaga. I'm very happy about that swap. I think that's a very interesting swap. They needed to, at a minimum, replace Cody Bellinger's bat. Well, they got Cody Bellinger back. And even that, you know, I understand he's probably not going to produce at the same level he did last year. But I don't know who out there would have that the Cubs were going to sign. So, you know, they probably did the best they could on that front. They needed to add a second bat. They would say they did in Michael Busch. And we'll see how that goes. I found that to be a very interesting move. I do like Busch. I think there's potential there that he is a middle of the order impact bat. We'll see. That especially makes sense in an offseason where, again, there weren't a lot of impact bats available. So I get that. They needed surefire veteran leader, innings guaranteed reliever type of guy, and they got that in Hector Neris. And I think they probably could have used another of that type. And, you know, Yency Almonte and the Michael Bush trade, you could argue that that's that he is that guy. And I think, again, I think the Cubs probably would say that. So I wouldn't go as far as to say this was an incredible offseason or a flawless offseason or anything, but it's very hard for me to look at this offseason and say that it was bad or not effective or not, or didn't set the Cubs up for contention in 2024. I mean, this has been true now the last couple off seasons. All I wanted to see was the Cubs arrive at spring training, or in the case of Cody Bellinger arriving later, by mid spring training, to look like the best roster on paper in the Central. That's a low bar because I don't think the Central is particularly strong right now. But I think they have accomplished that. I know that the Cardinals are generally projected for a couple more wins by Vegas and by the projection systems. Maybe. I don't see it myself, but I think I could definitely make the argument the Cubs are the best on paper team in the Central, and that's really all I was looking for by the end of this offseason. And again, I think the upgrade to Craig Counsell is meaningful. I think it's going to matter, not just this year, but in years ahead.
Yeah, that's one thing that I've been thinking about a lot, especially thinking the recent years of the Cubs-Brewers, we'll call it rivalry. I know that there's a lot of folks that would argue what kind of rivalry is. We refer to their ballpark as Wrigley North. We've got folks like Dom and all the other Twitter personalities, you know, making fun of them giving away tickets and all the things they try to stop us from being up there. But I feel like my gut always tells me when we would play the Brewers, it felt like the same game every time, in which there would be a deployed starter with high K rate, very well-positioned defensive players. The Cubs would smack the bejesus out of the ball right where a guy was standing like three or four times a game, and then we'd get to the seventh, and there'd be some guy we hadn't heard of before, Devin Williams and Josh Hader, and it would be over. And it was just an absolute nightmare to watch. I felt it was the most frustrating thing. But I thought when David Stearns left that organization that this game plan management that they seem to like have really mastered in the last few years with coming in every year. And I remember on your podcast with Sahadev and Patrick, you guys would be talking about going into the season and the Pakoda would say the Brewers are going to win 78 games. And that year they finished with 93 or 94 wins, like three or four seasons in a row. And I am really hoping that's the Craig Counsell effect. That's somewhere I'm putting a lot of eggs in that basket. He seems to be a very, very intelligent baseball guy. He has his fingers in a lot of things. I've enjoyed the Athletics pieces talking about, like, he's just popped his head in every department and has challenged things. And Jed Hoyer's comments about, jokingly saying he's afraid to call Craig because he's going to disagree with him. Like, I'm excited for that, I guess, organizational shift from David Ross. I didn't have the issues that some fans had with David Ross, and not saying he was a perfect manager, but I think it was time for a bigger change on, you know, the coaching aspect, because David Ross felt like a continuation of that connection of front office and that we see so common. Another question I would like to ask, and this is feeling out of order of what I originally intended, but Bleacher Nation, you guys seem to get a lot of views. You have a lot of wide coverage for all the Chicago sports teams, all of it just top notch, on top of the ball. What is the origin story for Bleacher Nation? If I recall correctly, before you started the website, you were a lawyer and kind of transitioned into doing this full time. Can you give us some background and, you know, how this came to be?
Yeah, so it's been, I started Bleacher Nation in late 2008. So now it's been, 15 and a half years?
Wow.
Which is crazy. I did it, I started doing it because, for a couple of reasons. So I was a lawyer at the time, and you do ton of reading and writing and analysis as a lawyer, which is fine. You know, I was cultivating some skills that way, but it wasn't like what I wanted to be writing about, wasn't what I wanted to be analyzing. And I kind of wanted to put some of those skills into something that I was a little more passionate about. And so I started this blog for fun. And I think I also thought deep down in my heart, you know, maybe this could become something. Maybe there's a gap in the market for fan-voiced news coverage and analysis sort of at an obsessive level. I kind of felt like we didn't quite have that. There's a lot of very traditional blogs that were just sort of ranting fans, which I don't mean in a critical way. Like that is an interesting area too. And then you had traditional media that was doing sort of the daily coverage, but sure. I kind of wanted to fill that gap. And so I did it nights and weekends kind of thing for about 3.5 years while I was lawyering, and started to get a little bit of a following then. And then we had our first kiddo in 2011, and it became clear very soon after her birth that I was looking long-term. I was not going to want to keep being a lawyer. I was at a large law firm, and I could see what the career trajectory was, and it was not something that was going to work for me at a personal level, just for what I wanted for my life. And so I, as a giant nerd, prepared a PowerPoint presentation for my wife about what I thought if I left the law and turned to Bleacher Nation full time. I sort of had projections, and here's where I thought what I could do. And she was very gracious and let me go that route. And even more importantly, she is a teacher and she has health insurance. And it was a risk we could take together. And that was mid 2011. And I got very lucky in the timing on that, because as folks will recall, mid 2011 is when Jim Hendry got dismissed after the Ricketts had taken over, and the obsessive Theo watch kicked in about August of that year. And so I was well positioned to be obsessive because it was my job. So I could just constantly be on everything. And I think a lot of people were looking for that. And so that just helped build a bit of a foundation of readership, and then kept growing from there. And it was, 2015 or so, 2014, 2015 or so, when the readership was large enough that I knew that I couldn't quite keep up with the demand on my own. And that was when Michael Cerami and Luis Medina came in to help. They were contributing. And eventually they became full-timers. We added football coverage. Michael then was... he became kind of a partner to me in running it, and we added more sports, more guys to write. And it just sort of, you know, I always say that I didn't set out to like build a business and run a business. It was just a business kind of grew up around what I was trying to do, which was just be a guy writing about the Cubs. And I'm very appreciative of all the support I got along the way, all the readers, but also the guys, the writers, my wife. And, you know, I was very fortunate. And so now within the last year, we were acquired by another company that can provide a lot of the back end support. Michael took over as sort of the boss of Bleacher Nation. I then was able to step back and return to just writing about the Cubs. And that was a very important thing at this stage in my life for me and my family, because I've got 3 kids now, and just a lot going on that side of life.
Sure.
So, you know, it's a bit of an arc, but I'm excited that after these 15 years, like I said, that I'm still able to do something that I love, and that that I hope still brings entertainment to, and, you know, a distraction in people's day out there. I think I can feel good about that. So I'm very appreciative.
No, I think that's great. I relate to that story so much, and just the passion for this team and, you know, chasing a dream of being a part of a community, or, you know, filling a gap of trying to provide insight and such on a sport that has and can grab the attention of an individual for, you know, a large part of the year. It's one of the things, you know, that I have come to love about baseball is it is a very long season. I know there's a lot of folks that don't enjoy that about it, but I do enjoy it. There's this consistency of every day having something new and turning the page. It's not the NFL where you have to wait a whole week to find out, you know, if any adjustment can be made, or, right, you know, it's this constant. And I'm also a self-proclaimed nerd, and, you know, I am a data guy. That is where, you know, I feel like a lot of my passions lie. And, you know, I worked in insurance for 10 years, and during the pandemic transitioned my career into analytics. And just wanted a complete shift. And the reason has always been the Cubs and baseball. And that's that I've wanted to just dive as deep as I can to learn as much as I can. But, oh boy, we just lost Brett.
Look, guys, this is a live podcast and we had a little bit of technical difficulties, but we got Brett right back. Please continue to enjoy the interview.
You were just saying you wanted to dive in completely.
Yes, and that's, you know, I think writing for Northside Baseball, I used to just write for fun, and now I write for very minimum compensation, and it's the justification of continuing to do it. And it gives me some chances to, you know, practice analytical thought process and, you know, putting together, you know, better data, you know, analyzed results in baseball. And yeah, it's led to meeting folks in the baseball space in this podcast where, you know, I think the original idea was a joke, was I needed a place to vent out all the Cubs stuff that was in my brain. I feel like every day I'm like a tea kettle and the Cubs heat that tea kettle and it's got to go out. My poor wife has been the recipient of that steam. And I felt, I'm like, I need somewhere else to put this. And I've been the Cubs guy in every office that I've ever worked in. Just would spend most of my days finding the people who were the Cubs fans and, you know, talking theories and all trade possibilities and everything under the sun. So, yeah, this is, yeah, your story is just so inspiring of, you know, kind of grabbing a passion and running with it. Especially, I think it can be challenging when you're in a career that is lucrative and you have family and all these other aspects that make taking that leap very hard. And yeah, I just, you know, respect what you've done and what you've built. It's it really is, you know, to me, the like the top place to get Cubs coverage. So transitioning a little bit to some final questions about this specific team, I guess like gun to your head isn't necessarily the phrasing I want to use, but that's the first thing that came to mind. The team itself, you know, has, I do agree with you, is structured to be the best in a margin play NL Central, in which there was no motivation to be the Dodgers. I understand that philosophy. It's chasing what they are can be, you know, seen irresponsible because it's not needed in the division the Cubs are in. But what do you imagine the floor of results are for the 2024 Cubs?
Yeah, it's funny you asked that as the question, because as you were talking about it, I was thinking in my head, I'm like, you know, the nice thing about this team is that they should have a pretty good floor. And you base that on depth mostly. I mean, they do have a number of impactful players, but these, you know, a pitching and defense kind of team with the potential to be a little above average offensively. People forget they were like the eighth best offense in baseball last year by a number of metrics. Didn't feel like it, but they were.
No, I was actually just looking at this the other day. It was impressive, their runs per game and their low home run rate. There's just a lot of like naturally built rallies. And I think with a little more slug, like if they can return to that level, it might get better. That's my hope. It's the optimistic view, but
sure. That. And they did. There was a little bit of noise in that because they had some blowouts that did that whole thing. But sure. But even by weighted runs created plus, they were an above average offense, and I think they can run that back this year reasonably well enough. And you certainly then hope for things like Michael Bush being an impact bat, Christopher Morel taking another step forward, Dansby Swanson maybe performing a little better over the course of the year, say Suzuki being the guy he was in the last couple months. I mean, you can go through it and you can see the outline of a pretty solid offense. But that's the upside, you know, for the outcome. The floor feels like a lot of redundancy on the roster to cover when those injuries happen, when underperformance happens. Great defense all around, generally speaking. We'll see what happens at third base, but really deep roster of relievers to pull from. A lot of them optionable, just a lot of maneuverability with that, which I think also creates a floor. And Craig Counsell, again, not to fall back on it, but I tend to think it's true. I think, and David Ross was certainly good at this part too. So it's not setting up a comparison, but Craig Counsell, I don't think is a guy who's going to let things get away from the team, let the wheels come off. And I think that too sets up a floor. Now, do I think this Cubs team has as much upside? You know, if everything goes right, okay. I can probably make the argument that if everything goes right, the Reds have a better team. If everything goes right, the Brewers might be better. And if everything goes right, the Cardinals might be better. Because for as much as I say, I think they're a little overrated, they do have guys like Mason Winn and Jordan Walker that, you know, potentially could explode into superstars this year. That could happen. And Nolan Arenado could bounce back and Paul Goldschmidt could bounce back. And so I get all that. And I think if everything goes great for a lot of these teams, not to sleep on the Pirates, by the way, either. They have a ton of young talent. This whole division, top to bottom, is
100%
very high variance.
yes.
Yeah. So I think it's one of those that, like, if you simulated the division 100 times, the Cubs probably win it 55 times. And then within those 45 times that they don't win it, probably a few huge, crazy, awesome seasons from these other teams.
I think, too, to kind of expand on that point, I think the Cubs in this division might be the best setup to add at the trade deadline. So to me, it's like going to into the season, being in the division, there is some positional, depth, especially I'm looking at the outfield, that I thought we would see some of those prospects move in a deal this offseason. It didn't, obviously, it didn't really manifest itself. I have a lot of tinfoil hat theories of timing of signings and whether or not you could be comfortable dangling certain players until, like maybe a Cody Bellinger was, locked up or those types of things. And all those things just happened so late. I'm not sure how firm any of those negotiations are, but I do like think about some of the rumors we had, like, Bo Bichette and some of these other random players, Shane Bieber, obviously another one they were tied to a lot. Like, that to me at least seems like there's some groundwork for discussions that, different parts of your maybe next offseason or the trade deadline. And it'll be interesting to see if the Cubs will be able to move some of that, perceived outfield depth to add another arm in this rotation. Especially I think the one thing I worry the most about is swing and miss. There's not as much swing and miss in the pitching as I'd like. But there are some really intriguing options with like Ben Brown, maybe Cade Horton starts as a bullpen piece. We've seen the Brewers kind of implement that model with some of their top end rotation arms of, giving them a cup of coffee and these situations in which they just can go out and throw it, not worry about stamina and management. That's one thing I think I'll be interested in seeing Craig Counsell manage that aspect. I think that's like where the Cubs are roster wise. Craig Counsell seems to have done just a very good job in Milwaukee of setting expectations for these young players and telling them to do like what they do best. And like you look at like Sal Frelick and some other folks, with Garrett Mitchell, Bryce Terang, you know, they weren't necessarily hitting for that Brewers team, but they were at times providing absolutely elite defense, which was getting them into, you know, into that lineup. And I feel that, you know, having them trot out there and knowing what their job is, like that approach from Council, I'm very interested to see how he like manages some of these young kids.
You know, I think some Cubs fans would hate to hear it this way, but I think the Cubs probably wouldn't hate if with Craig Council and a very diverse roster that they have right now, I don't think the Cubs would hate if they performed like a Brewers team with a little more money. That's, I think that's kind of what they are looking to be. And we'll see if they bring that financial advantage to bear at midseason. Like you said, I think they're well set up with some prospect overlaps that they can make some trades if and not sort of really harm the system. But they'll also have to have the flexibility to take on salary. And we'll see. They're right there at that luxury tax line right now.
Yeah, I honestly thought there would be some addressing of that, either commitment to just going over it now, because it feels like if they're going to add at the trade deadline, it's inevitable that they're likely to go over. So why not? I don't know, you know, maybe you're better versed in this. I don't know if there is any difference in how the penalty or the being over to CBT is evaluated, if it happens at mid-year or if it happens now. So maybe they just don't see the opportunity of adding something now to go over, but still intend to go over.
I think they just don't want to say it publicly, because there's no upside in confirming it. And also then, if you don't say anything, then you have the flexibility at midseason. If the team struggles, you would be able to trade away and get back under. And it's not as if you went against anything you said you were going to do. So I really think that's all it is. And I think we have to kind of, as fans, hope that if the team is good, they really will push in at midseason and do what's necessary to take on salary to get the guys that can impact.
I think my final question, and this is obviously, you know, just a gut reaction. Next offseason, they've got a lot of money coming off the books. You look at, you know, how Jed is managed and how the CBT has been managed by this front office. You know, I think to me, I know going into the offseason, I had unreasonably high hopes of being in the Shohei Ohtani sweepstakes, with the underlying logical caveat of I didn't think he'd leave the West Coast. But then there was the fan in me that was, well, he talked to us last time and thought that I would be wearing a Shohei Ohtani Cubs jersey at an All-Star game at Wrigley Field, watching the guy just hit nukes. But that dream exploded on me very early in November, or December. But with Juan Soto coming off, how do you feel that he fits onto this roster, if at all? And do you think for a player like that, that is a player that this front office will get aggressive on? And I feel like I already know the answer. Should they get aggressive on? I feel like that is an obvious yes.
Yeah, I mean, given his age and the impact of that bat, I mean, there's no argument against wanting him. And I think the Cubs would say that too. That of course they would love to have him. I think the reality of the situation is this front office and this ownership group have a strong aversion to super long contracts. Whether there's value there or not is something we can and do debate. But they don't see it that way. They just do not want to commit to have things on the books for that far into the future. And I think we all know Juan Soto, if he and Scott Boras want a 15-year deal, which would take him to age 41, they're going to be able to get that. And the Cubs are not going to do that, period. And I think even if they were, we have to be honest that if the Yankees and the Mets are going to be super hardcore in on Juan Soto, Are the Cubs winning that bidding war? Has anything in the last 10 years, given you evidence that the Cubs are gonna outbid? No. And so I think what you have to fall back on is they do have a strength in the outfield in terms of young talent. There are worse, I can imagine worse scenarios to miss out on a guy. All that said, Juan Soto is special and I love him and I really wish he was going to be this cornerstone guy for the Cubs for a decade, superstar. And they don't, that's one thing they don't have, is they don't have that guy who is sort of a terrifying presence in the lineup. And it just, where you consistently know you're going to get monster performance. Now, there aren't that many guys like that in the game. Very few teams have that guy. So I'm not saying like the Cubs are way behind the curve by not having that guy. It's just, it's a bummer that they don't. They're almost certainly not going to pay in this way to get one. And so you're just going to have to hope that that comes internally.
Yeah. And I think, I always try to think of like the marketability of a player and what that brings to the team. And yeah, I think it's frustrating exactly what you said. I know that baseball is different. It doesn't have the same, it does revenue sharing agreement that, other sports have, and being able to sell jerseys with a certain player's name on and such is, all good for the Cubs. It's not anything that goes to another team. And yeah, I think that's one thing that's so interesting when evaluating this team is there's not, in pardon the accidental pun here, a marquee player that, you can market. Cody Bellinger is probably the closest thing. And, obviously his free agency went on as long as it did because of the question marks, the health and all the things, and whether or not that was deserving of, a long-term high value contract. And yeah, I think when I think of Soto and the good tide rises all boats, I always think of, well, then there's so much marketing you could do with him, and that's going to cover some of the cost of the contract and like the value of the contract, especially we've seen some of these monster deals like Bryce Harper and stuff like age super well, because with, no hard cap, no max contract value, these things just keep getting bigger and bigger, like writing off, $50 million or whatever number it ends up being in 10 years might be a bargain if there's not like just dynamic change in how baseball finances are looked at and how team payroll is looked at. So it's definitely something that I'm trying really hard not to get hyper about for the next off season. But yeah, it's just hard to not look at that guy and imagine what he does for a lineup. And, I play a lot of baseball video games. I'm a big MLB The Show guy. I always ask myself when the Cubs roster is done, it's like, who would be on the cover of MLB The Show? And right now, I don't think there's a guy on the Cubs that really fits that profile. And, as someone who is like really into things like that, that just disappoints me. It doesn't make me sad about the team. It doesn't make me think they're not a good team. It is different, especially when like coming off that 2016 group where you had like these largely marketable, great personalities, like ideal, like superstar, like players, Chris Bryant before all his health issues and such. But I had a final question and I rambled on too long to remember it, but thank you so much for your time, Brett. I really appreciate it. And if anyone is looking for your stuff, do a plug of anything that's going on Bleacher Nation and just share social media networks with folks who are listening.
Yeah, sure. I think the best two would be bleachernation.com, and you can check out my Cubs coverage there. And I run the Bleacher Nation Twitter account. I refuse to call it X, but so at Bleacher Nation, just give that a follow and you'll see me on there too. I think those are the best places.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm also on the I won't call it X. Like, what are we? And when you tweet something, are you Xing it? I don't understand. But that's a completely different conversation for a different podcast. But once again, I'm Jeff Rogowskis, Canada Cubs. You can find me on all social media platforms. I'm on X as Canada Cubs, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, you name it, I'm there. Thanks again for listening. This has been another episode of Bricks Behind the Ivy. See you guys next week.